Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, September 22nd. Call Your Senator, our monthly call-in with my questions and yours for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, New York's junior senator, as the label goes, though not so junior anymore, as she's been in the Senate since 2009. It's just that Chuck Schumer has been there since the last century. There is some news this week that relates to Senator Gillibrand's longevity. Every year since 2013, some of you know this, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Gillibrand has introduced a provision to the Pentagon budget bill to reform the military justice system so that cases of sexual assault are adjudicated outside the chain of command. Why? Because the commanding officers might have close ties to the accused or might be the sexual assaulters themselves. Finally, enough Republican senators on the Armed Services Committee are agreeing to this, and the provision is going to the full Senate. But perhaps strangely, the Democratic House of Representatives, from what I read, has a weaker version that needs to be reconciled. So we'll talk about that. I'm also curious how much money might come out of the defense budget to help fund the Democrats' progressive priorities now that President Biden has ended the endless war in Afghanistan and to reverse Donald Trump's military spending buildup. Senator, always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. I love being on your show.
And you're calling these the biggest reforms to the military justice system in U.S. history. Want to explain them to everyone?
Yes, and you did a very good job yourself. Unfortunately, the scourge of sexual violence in the military is nothing new, and it's been going on forever, really. When I started getting involved about a decade ago, there were approximately 20,000 sexual assaults, rapes, and unwanted sexual contact in the military every year. And that was the DOD's estimate. Last year, when they made a similar estimate, it was still about 20,000. And we have tried over the last 10 years to do lots of reforms, change the evidentiary standards, give the survivors counsel, create a fairer system. But nothing's worked. And in fact, what survivors have told us from the beginning is that they don't often report these crimes because they don't believe their commander will have their back. Oftentimes, their perpetrator is someone within the chain of command. Oftentimes, their perpetrator is more senior to them. And so the way the chain of command works is just there's a deference. And for a lot of survivors, they just didn't think the military would have their back if they reported. And that's not surprising, because when men and women do report these crimes, approximately 62% of them are retaliated against for reporting the crime. And so they are the ones blamed. They're either retaliated peer-to-peer or by administrative retaliation or professional retaliation, and often wind up being kicked out of the military and given a dishonorable discharge or a discharge without benefits based on diagnoses of personality disorders, which is, again, a form of retaliation. So we've been trying to do this reform for about 10 years. We wanted to take the decision-making about whether a case goes to trial and give that decision to a trained military prosecutor, because today that decision is made by a commander who may have bias. They may prefer the accused, somebody more important for the unit, important for the mission. They may just have bias against women or men in general. They might have different kinds of racial biases. We don't know. We just know they're not highly trained as lawyers, and they're not highly trained as prosecutors to do the one simple thing: weigh the evidence and make an unbiased decision about whether a case should go forward. And so we finally got 66 senators to agree that this reform was a good one. We took that support to the Armed Services Committee when we wrote the National Defense Bill in the Senate, and we were able to keep those provisions in the full committee, and it is in the version coming out of the Senate. Sadly, the House did not do the same work that we did. We did not have the same level of support within the committee, and we just didn't have sustained advocacy for this proposal over the past 10 years in the way that we did in the Senate. And so as a consequence, they didn't have the support they felt they needed to put it in the base bill. They didn't call a vote, which I would have loved them to call, and they didn't mark up the bill, which I would have loved them to do. But so now our goal is to try to keep it in the Senate bill. The two bills go in conference, and unfortunately, because the chairman of the House and the chairman of the Senate are not supportive of this measure, it will likely be taken out in conference. The only recourse for survivors then is to ask for an up or down vote on the U.S. Senate floor and then get an up or down vote on the House floor. We will ask for that vote, and hopefully we will be given it and can show that this is a measure whose time has come and that these reforms are necessary to protect all survivors and to protect men and women in the military who deserve a justice system worthy of their sacrifice.
So it sounds like, despite it getting further this year, you think it's going to fail again. But if I heard you right, part of the reason will be the chairman of the relevant committee in the House is opposed to these reforms. I don't know who that is, but I assume in Nancy Pelosi's House with a Democratic majority, that's a Democrat. So who's that?
Well, both the chairman in the House and Senate from the Democratic side and the Republican side do not support this. So both Jack Reed and Adam Smith have not publicly supported this measure. They support versions of it, half steps, taking out just sexual assault or sexual assault and sexual harassment, which is a great first step, but without a bright line at all serious crimes, you are preferencing one group of plaintiffs and one group of defendants over all else. You also run the risk of having special treatment for those who are survivors of sexual assault who are more often than not women. And so legal experts have said you run the risk of creating something that will appear as a pink court, something that will appear to be special treatment. And female service members and male service members don't want to be perceived as getting special treatment. They want one system of justice for everyone. So we need more work. The good news is we have a president who supports this bill. Joe Biden has not only run on this reform, he wanted to take out all serious crimes. When asked about murder or rape or child abuse, he said, yes, 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 take them all out. So he believes in the bright line at serious crimes, at felonies, which creates a justice system that's good for everybody, not just one set of crimes. So that's the work we have to do. We have to urge the president to weigh in with the chairman, maybe, but also urge the survivor community and people who want to see this reform to be heard with those in power. And you just have to recognize, Brian, the DOD is very powerful, and they don't want to change how they do this. President Biden has insisted through Secretary Austin that this one reform has to take place, particularly the sexual assault being removed from the chain of command. But the DOD is trying to limit that change to just one crime. And I think that'd be a mistake. And the perfect example of why it's a mistake is Vanessa Guillen. And she is a woman who was murdered by her perpetrator. She had not reported to the DOD harassment or assault prior to that murder, but we know from her family that she was being harassed. So under this system, if you only take out sexual assault and harassment, she would not have had the proper review of her case, and her perpetrator might have gone unpunished. And that's a problem. So we really want the bright line at serious crimes.
Question for you as a member of the Armed Services Committee from Elliot in Manhattanville. Elliot, you're on WNYC with Senator Gillibrand.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning, Senator. I just want to know, and you can do this in any context you want. Can you just tell us who the joint, I know the name of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His name is Mark Milley. He's been in the news a lot. I don't care about the news story, really. What is the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Like, what's the function? Where does he fit in the whole DOD military, he or she? You know what I mean?
Elliot, thank you. Okay, civics lesson time. What is the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and what is the role of the chairman at the moment, Mark Milley?
So Mark Milley's role is to advise the president. He is the most senior military officer to advise the president on all policy and all issues related to national security. It's the reason why the Secretary of Defense is not supposed to be a military personnel. It's the reason why the SecDef is supposed to be a civilian, which is a fight we've had for the last 15 years. But the Joint Chiefs of Staff are a collective body that's headed by the chairman, who sets the agenda and presides over all the Joint Chiefs of Staff's meetings. They take a senior person from each of the services, and they are able to create a council to advise the president on military issues and national security issues.
Elliot, thank you. Thank you very much. I want to ask you about the human infrastructure bill that we keep hearing referred to as the $3.5 trillion spending bill. I think that number is misleadingly high based on what I've read, because at least half of it gets paid for within the bill itself. And $3.5 trillion is also the cost over 10 years, not 1 year. But I've been asking guests to talk about the content of the plan, not just the price tag, which I think bogs us down in numbers rather than is it worth it. I know you're a supporter, so can you make your case for what people would get for their money on this that you think is important and worth it?
Absolutely. So we saw how society was really harmed because of COVID. People had to stay home from work. People had to watch their kids learn remotely. People lost their jobs because many industries collapsed. People did not have resources. And we really saw the fraying of the social safety net in a way we've never seen before. And we saw where it was really lacking. So what this bill does is rebuild our infrastructure from the ground up, the human infrastructure, as you mentioned, in the ways that would protect us going forward, but also in the ways that address things like income inequality. So, for example, one of the most important pieces of legislation in this bill is a paid family leave policy. We are the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a national paid leave policy. And what paid leave would have done is if you were sick, you could have stayed home for up to 3 months and been paid, not lost your job, but getting a certain percentage of your wages with about a $4,000 a month cap. It would have been so much easier just to fund paid leave than to have to create all these different new programs for unemployment insurance, for checks per child, all the things we put in place because we had no other way to protect people from falling through the cracks. So you'd get paid leave if you were sick, you'd get paid leave if your child was sick, you'd get paid leave if your child was stuck at home because he was remote learning, you'd get paid leave if you were with a parent who was dying and needed to care for them. That's what paid leave's for. Up to 3 months paid, you don't lose your spot in your company, and your company then can use your salary to pay for a replacement worker if it's still open and in business. Second thing it would have is affordable daycare. Again, daycare in our country is unaffordable for most people and unavailable because there's not enough of it. Before the pandemic, there was one slot for every 4 kids that needed it. Post-pandemic, there was one slot for every 8 kids that needed it. That's a problem because if you're a young parent and you have a child who is before they get to kindergarten, there's no place for your child except for daycare at home. And that might be 4 years where you have no income and can't provide for your child. If you're low income or a single parent, that's not possible. So you're going to need care. Third, universal pre-K. That would be a whole year where children would get access to good, high-quality early learning to set them on the right path for success. Every dollar you put into early education, you get something like $11, $12, $13 out in economic benefit for what that child will accomplish over their lifetime. So it's one of the best investments in money. It would also have things that were really lacking, like funding for housing, public housing. We've seen all those horrible stories about the conditions of public housing throughout New York. That's true all across the country, and just the lack of affordable housing. There'd be money for things like debt forgiveness for our farmers. There'd be money for 9/11 health bill. There'd be money for things like places where our education system and our job training system aren't working. So the versions we have it now is 2 years free of community college for all Americans so that you can get a basic college education, it debt-free and something that is publicly available. also increasing Pell Grants to make sure that when we invest in minority-serving institutions, including HBCUs, that they have the resources for every kid who wants to get an education. And then last, there's going to be a big investment in the environment. And I think we clearly see with the unbelievable flooding New York has continued to see and the loss of life and the loss of the businesses and homes that we have to do something about global climate change. So it does a couple of things. It will create incentives for clean energy and transportation. It creates incentives for clean electricity, incentives for conservation in agriculture. It creates a climate core to do job training for people who want to go into these industries. And I think it also will put a price on carbon, and there'll be a carbon fee structure that I think we're working on as well. So those are big changes. And I agree with what you said, Brian. I don't know what the final amount of money is going to be that we invest in this. 3.5 is not a magic number. It can be less. But what's necessary is that these are the programs that are created. And my view is that this should be funded for as long as it possibly can be, making as many of these programs permanent as we can afford, and explaining to the American people why we are building this human infrastructure, why we are building a better, a fairer, more just society so that everyone can thrive and recover from COVID. I think we have a big, strong case to make, and these are all things that I've been fighting for about a decade. So they're not new. They're not unnecessary spending. They're actually the things that would make the economy and families and communities stronger.
And thank you for going into so much detail about the content. You know, I wanted to tie together our two major topics so far today, the Human Infrastructure Plan and the Defense Authorization Act. But I see that Burl in Manhattan wants to do that too, and I'm going to let her start it. Burl, you're on WNYC with Senator Gillibrand. Hello.
Hi. Well, I am continuously shocked by the huge percentage of our budgets committed to the military, and I'm just wondering if there's any possibility of discussion of changing that those expenditures, because it sounds, as my impression is, it's just out of sight of how much money we spend on this hardware that's not even, half of it never even is completed, I think. Anyway, and that money could certainly go to helping people and changing our priorities.
Burl, yes. Thank you very much. And you know what? I'm going to pile on, Senator, before you respond, because I was going to ask you, too, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, how much you would propose to remove from the military budget now that we've ended the U.S. role in the war in Afghanistan, and we're looking for ways to fund human infrastructure. And I looked up some numbers this morning, and it looks like the current year military budget is around $730 billion, correct me if I'm wrong. In 2016, just before Trump's buildup, it was around $630 billion. In 2001, just before we launched the Afghanistan war, it was around $330 billion, at least based on the websites that I saw. Now we're done with what Biden and Trump both call endless wars, at least the Afghanistan one. So my question to you is, before we discuss raising taxes to pay for things, how many hundreds of billions of dollars of a peace dividend do you propose removing from the military?
I think you make a great point that we have been funding forever wars for 20 years, and that has been a significant commitment of resources, of time, of treasure, and of lives. And I think we can repurpose some of those resources, and I think we can look at how we should be investing from a national security perspective, aside from the other domestic goals that I just laid out. And that's one of the things that I hope I can do because I've joined the Intelligence Committee. And I think we should not be funding yesterday's wars. We don't need large permanent basing around the globe to meet our national security needs. We have one of the most nimble effective ability to project power when needed through special operations, through intelligence services, through technology. And we should be reimagining what national security looks for America. One of the things that I want to work on is cyber specifically. We know that America is attacked daily through cyber attack from places like China and Russia and Iran. They are sometimes debilitating attacks. I don't know how many business owners you've met, Brian, who have had to pay ransomware in the last year, but I can tell you it's an extraordinarily high number. We've had Russia trying to interfere with our democracy and hacking our election systems, trying to spread and create misinformation and division in the country. So we are being attacked readily, and I want to see us invest in areas where we've traditionally underinvested. We should be investing in DARPA. We should be investing in cyber. We should have a cyber academy so that kids who are good at languages and good at science and technology and engineering, math, who would like a free education and want to do public service.
One more from a caller on something completely different. Ricky in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Senator Gillibrand. Hi, Ricky.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. So, I just want to first say, Senator Gillibrand, thank you very much for doing what you're doing in the Senate, for being a fighter. You could use more people like you. My call is regarding the COVID EIDL, the economic injury disaster loan increase that a lot of us, so I own a restaurant on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. A lot of us small business owners have gotten the EIDL loan. However, the increase has been a bureaucratic nightmare. For example, I have been waiting about 7 months just for the SBA to confirm with the IRS regarding my tax transcripts. And a lot of us really need this increase right now. For example, my restaurant actually donated thousands of meals during the pandemic for the elderly and those in need. So I think right now we could honestly just use your help to give more of a voice to this sort of a thing. In fact, actually, I've reached out to your team a couple times over the past few months and haven't really gotten a response. I know we're all busy and stuff, but we really could use this right now.
Ricky, thank you. Senator, we have a minute left.
Hi, Ricky. Please email me at casework@gillibrand.senate.gov, and we will help you. I'm sorry you have not gotten an immediate response to your needs. One of the reasons why we fought so hard for the restaurant's provisions in the relief was because, obviously, restaurants are not only essential for our economy, but are essential for our communities. And I'm really grateful that you used your resources to help the elderly and to help those in need during the pandemic. And that courage and that selflessness is important. And I not only am extremely grateful, but I would love to help you make sure you get the resources you need to get back up and running. So please do reach out, and I'm happy to help you.
That's casework@gillibrand.senate.gov. Do I have that right?
Correct. And please give your name and number to the producer, and they'll contact us. And I'll make sure Caitlin from my office calls you back.
All right. I know our listeners always appreciate these conversations, Senator. We went places today I never expected we would go. The nature of patriarchy in society, what the Joint Chiefs of Staff are for, as well as specific policy items. So thank you for all of that. And we'll talk next month, if not before.
Well, thanks, Brian. That's why your program's so great.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.